Okay, welcome back. Hope you enjoyed your Thanksgiving. At the end last time, we were talking about the fact that rotation is not entirely free about single bonds. Even in ethane, there's a barrier that's about 3 kilocalories per mole. And remember, you found that by the most surprising method, which is measuring the heat capacity of ethane. There are other ways of getting the barrier. You see here in this table from 2003, the first one is heat capacity, which gave this barrier 1,006 wave numbers, or the units it's measured in here. You multiply by 2.86 and you get it in small calories per mole. So 1,000 means about 3 kilocalories per mole, 2.9 kilocalories per mole. So there are other ways, IR, microwave, Raman spectroscopy, and then one can also calculate it by using quantum mechanics to calculate the energy for the staggered and the eclipsed, and see what the difference between. And you see that no matter what method you use, from relatively simple calculations to very, very complicated calculations, they all give about the same barrier and agree with experiment. Now, then there's another question. What's the source of the barrier in ethane? So calculation showed that the low energy form was the staggered, not the eclipsed, the one that had been drawn both by Van 't Hoff and by Paternot. So that was in fact the high energy form and not indeed an isomer. It's just the transition state that takes you from one isomer to the other. It's the barrier you have to go over. Now, what's the source of this 3 kilocalorie per mole barrier? That's a subtle question. You can calculate it without understanding it. Understanding is tough, and it's still controversial, really. It could be that the eclipsed form is destabilized, or it could be that the staggered form is unusually stable, and it's a question of compared to what, right? So why might the eclipsed form be destabilized? Well, obviously those protons are closer together in the eclipsed form than they are in the staggered form, where you rotate about the carbon-carbon bond and get them apart a little bit. And protons indeed should repel one another. But on the other hand, if you make the proton into a methyl group instead and have the molecule be propane rather than ethane, then it turns out the barrier is only very slightly higher, 3.4 kilocalories per mole. So it's not really the size of hydrogen that's doing it. If it were the size, then getting methyl, something that's obviously much bigger than hydrogen, you might expect would increase the barrier substantially. It doesn't increase it very much. So what else might be running into one another? Well, it could be the electrons in the bonds, because you have electrons in the bonds to CC that are very similar to the electrons in the bond to CH. So it could be that, but on the other hand, there's also attraction between the protons and the electrons in the bond. So it's really a pretty subtle question as to actually what you would expect for that. On the other hand, if you want to say the staggered form is stabilized, why should it be stabilized? Why should it be unusually stable? So previously we were saying that the eclipsed form might be unusually unstable. It could be instead that the staggered form is unusually stable. And one point of view that's been advocated from that perspective is that you might get mixing of sigma and sigma star when the bonds are lined up with this. So the electrons in sigma on the left could overlap a little with the vacant orbital sigma star on the right and therefore be stabilized. Right. Now, you might think that could be even better if it's rotated so that they're adjacent to one another rather than far from one another. But in fact, it's not too hard, I won't take the time to do it here, to see that the overlap between sigma and sigma star is actually bigger in this phase of rotation than it is when they're both pointing up. I don't think that would agree with my intuition. I don't know if it agrees with yours. I would think that when they're like this, they would overlap more than when they're like that. But it's not hard to show that, in fact, the overlap is bigger that way. And there are other places where that crops up, the big overlap between anti-groups. Yeah.
Why does that create stabilization, sigma and sigma star?
Because one's a homo and the other's a lumo. You mix homo-lumo, you get a stabilization, right? That's the old story. Okay, but in fact, no one is, there's still argument about this. So it's a good example of the fact that often with quantum mechanics you can calculate something, but understanding it is a more challenging proposition. And there you see that it's the homo-lumo mixing that would do it, and that resonant structure you could draw that would denote that, that would have a partial double bond between the carbons. That's called hyperconjugation. So basically this is still a matter for philosophers. Okay, now we're going to talk just a little bit about a topic that's often not discussed in freshman organic, but it's or in organic chemistry courses, beginning organic chemistry courses. But topicity is an interesting subject and quite related to some aspects of biology or biochemistry, so I think it's worth talking about. And topicity has to do with placeness. In fact, that's what topicity means. Now, here's a question. Are these two protons, the red hydrogen and the blue hydrogen, equivalent? Well, at first glance, that's a no-brainer. A proton is a proton. They're all the same. But they could be different because they're in different places. They could behave differently. So those particular hydrogens I mean to be part of ethanol. So one of them is attached to carbon, the other is attached to oxygen. So their behavior could be different. They're involved in different orbitals, even though as isolated protons, obviously they're the same. One, for example, has a property that its pKa, that its acidity is about 16, the pKa. So that's alcohol or water. But the other one has a pKa of 50. It's 10 to the 44th. Less acidic in its equilibrium constant. So they obviously have very different properties. That one will exchange readily with acidic water. You can imagine how this mechanism works. Think about it just a second. So you have protons floating around in acidic water. What are they going to react with? What makes the proton reactive? Get back into gear here. Yeah, Derek? Lone pair on oxygen, fine. So, or to see that there's exchange, you'd want it to be deuterium rather than protium. Okay, otherwise you wouldn't know. Okay, so we put deuterium in, it'll react with the unchaired pair, and you'll get that. Now, of course, had those been two hydrogens, it would be symmetrical. But because it's deuterium, it's not. And you could, of course, reverse the first step and lose D plus, but you could also lose H plus from that. So you can have H plus come off, and now you've exchanged deuterium for protium. So that happens easily. But you don't have the unchaired pair to work with in the other one. The other one won't exchange with water, so there's a property that's quite different. So these protons are called heterotopic. Hetero means different, and topos in Greek means place. So they're different because the place they're in is different. They're heterotopic. Now, the three blue hydrogens there on the methyl group you'd expect to behave similarly or identically. They're homotopic, and the two green ones on the methylene group are homotopic. But they're not exactly superimposable. They're homotopic only from the point of view of constitution, right? What they're bonded to, they're bonded by single bonds. The nature of the bonds is the same. They're bonded in one case to carbon, in the other to a carbon that's bonded to CH2. In the other case, they're bonded to a carbon that's bonded to O and CH3. So constitutionally, they're homotopic. But conformationally, they're not homotopic. Right, because they're in different locations within the molecule. Now let's look at that topicity. Let's look at stereo topic, relationships, among atoms or groups that are constitutionally homotopic. So they're attached by the same bonds to the corresponding atoms and so on, but from the point of view of arrangement in space, they're different. Okay, let's consider those two hydrogens. Right? Are they homotopic? Are their environments superimposable? Are their environments superimposable? Okay. Well, no. One is coming out of the board. One is in the plane with carbon-carbon oxygen, and one doesn't lie in that plane. So from the point of view of conformation, that is, if we don't allow rotation about single bonds, then they're different. They would be heterotopic from that point of view. In fact, they're diastereotopic, right? They're just plain different. Okay. Now, how about the two hydrogens on top? Are they diastereotopic? Are their environments just plain different? Or do they have a special relationship? Brian, what do you say? They're what? Can't hear very well. They're mirror images of one another. So what will we call those? Those two. Enantiotopic, right? Okay. Now, how about the two? These distinctions, notice, are only with respect to a frozen conformation, right? In fact, those relationships will be erased if the thing rotates. It rotates 10 to the 12th times per second or something like that, right? So one wouldn't expect them to behave differently in any long-term way, but instantaneously they could be enantiotopic, or in the other case, diastereotopic. Yeah, Sharif?
Couldn't you look at it from the other angle and say that the diastereotopic ones are enantiotopic? Or are those not
all? No, you look at the environment. So take the H you're interested in away and look at what's left. Okay? Now, if you look at take those two that are in the front, the ones we say are diastereotopic, take the H you're interested in away, take the other H away, and can those two things that are left, the environments of the H's, be superimposed? No, because one has an H on the bottom and the other doesn't. You see what I'm saying? Their environments are not the same. They're not superimposable. The two on the top are mirror images. The plane of the screen reflects one into the other. So they're enantiotopic. Okay? Yeah, Sinead?
You're saying they're mirror images like on just like the carbon, not throughout the rest of it?
No, the whole thing. Their whole environment, okay, is a mirror image. You see how that would be? Okay, because one of them has a hole in the front, the other one has a hole in the back, but a mirror that's the plane of the screen would reflect one in the front to one in the back, so they're mirror images of one another. Everything else lies in the plane. Pardon me? Well, the oxygen lies in the plane of the screen, right? So it doesn't get moved by that mirror. Okay, and the two green hydrogens are both there in the mirror image, or they're exchanged, but they're both there, so the environments are the same. Now those two are enantiotopic, right? Okay. But that distinction is not conformational, because you can't make the environment of this big one be like the environment of the one that's further away. By rotation. Does everyone see how that differs from here? Here you can make this one rotate to get where the back one is, right? But you can't do that here. You can't rotate and make this one go here, because if you rotate in this counterclockwise direction about the C-C bond and make this one go back there, you don't get the same environment, because that makes the OH come back down here. Right, so you can't get from this one to this one by rotation, but you can get from this one to that one by rotation. So the distinction between these is configurational, right? Not conformational. You'd need to break the bonds in order to change one into the other, to pull a hydrogen off from the back and put it in the front to exchange those two environments. So that'll last forever, at least until the bonds break. So one is just conformational. That goes away quickly. Okay, now, that carbon then is called prochiral. Right, we've talked about centers of chirality or stereogenic centers that can be R or S. This one is not R or S because it has two things that are the same on it, two hydrogens. But if you changed one of those two mirror image groups to be something else, then that carbon would be chiral. So it's called prochiral. It can become chiral, that carbon. So if those two enantiotopic atoms were made different, then that would be a chiral carbon. So that means we can name these two groups, these two hydrogens. That one, which we can see in a Newman projection, is the one on left by rotating the molecule. We could give a name to that place. Now, this is again a convention. The way you name those two places to distinguish one from the other is to say, if it had a little bit higher priority than the one that it matches really, if it had a higher priority, then what would the configuration of that carbon be? Okay? So if we try to give priority around that carbon, that is this carbon. Obviously, the highest priority is the oxygen. The next priority is the carbon, and then we come to the two hydrogens, both of which would be low. But artificially, if we're deciding to name this one, we say that this one has a higher priority than that one when we give the name. Okay? So 1, 2, this one would be 3, and that one would be 4. So the higher priority to the enantiotopic H being named, 1, 2, 3, 4. And now once we have that, we can fiddle around with our right and left hand and see if we make the thumb go from the carbon to number 4. Then the fingers of my left hand will curl 1, 2, 3, right? So this hydrogen is pro-S, right? It would become left-handed if that had a higher priority than the other one. So we name that one pro-S. And by the same token, if we want to name the other one, we give it higher priority than the one that's not being named, and that will be pro-R, because now the lowest priority is my thumb here, and we go 1, 2, 3, and that one is R. Okay, so we can name these two configurationally enantiotopic groups, hydrogens in this case. In other molecules, it could be anything. It could be two chlorines, it could be two methyl groups. Anything like that could be enantiotopic. Okay, now, is there a difference? Is there a good reason to worry about giving these things names? How will they behave differently? Well, suppose we take these two hydrogens, the pro-S on the left and the pro-R on the right here, and react one or the other with a chlorine atom. So the chlorine comes up and we get these single barbed arrows for single electron motion. We abstract hydrogen with chlorine, as in the Dumas stuff where he did substitutions of hydrogens by chlorine on alkanes. And we find that we replace, if we come from the left, we get the pro-S. If we come from the right, we get the pro-R. Now, what's the relationship between these two processes? Are they different, or are they mirror images of one another? The one that attacks the pro-S and the one that attacks the pro-R. Are they different, or would they have the same energy? What do you think? Yeah, they would have the same energy because there's a mirror here, right? That takes one into the other. They're mirror images of one another, so they would have the same rates, for example. Same energy, same rates. Okay, so there would be no difference between those, and if that were the case, it would be sort of silly to worry about giving names to things. So attacks by a reagent like chlorine atom are mirror images, and thus they're identical in rate. But suppose that the thing that was doing the attacking was itself handed. Right? Suppose it was an index finger of of the deity here in for Michelangelo. Okay, suppose it was a right hand that was abstracting. Now there it's abstracting the pro R, and if it came in from the other side, it could look like this, if I could do it, right? But that would be the left hand coming in. That would be the mirror image. If it had to be the right that was the reagent, then it would have to look like that. Or it could look like this, but this is not the mirror image of that. Okay? So now, the attacking the pro-R and attacking the pro-S hydrogens are not mirror images of one another. Right? Those things, so if you attack by a resolved chiral reagent, the two reactant processes are diastereomeric. They're not mirror images. So they should have different rates. Right? So in principle, you could take one of those hydrogens off selectively if you had a reagent that was of a single hand. Can you imagine a reagent of a single hand that might react with alcohol to pull a hydrogen off? That's what the liver does, right? To ethyl alcohol. It pulls those hydrogens off and makes an aldehyde. So if you take, for example, horse liver alcohol dehydrogenase, LAD, so it's a handed reagent that can pull off, that you'd expect it to be able to pull off one hydrogen more than the other. Now, is that true? Is it true that the enzyme discriminates between those two? How could you tell? Well, one way to tell would be to have the alcohol that had hydrogen in the pro-R position and deuterium in the pro-S position, and then see whether you do the dehydrogenation, lose H2. Here's the reaction we're going to do, right? When you do that, notice incidentally that what the liver alcohol dehydrogenase is taking off is not a proton. What's it taking off? Can you see? When it takes that H. Is it a proton that's being taken? What does it say over here? It's H minus, not H plus. Notice the arrow. It's taking the hydrogen together with its bonded electrons. Right? So it's taking off H minus. It's not a normal proton transfer. So the liver alcohol dehydrogenase takes the H with its electrons, and then the electrons can come from the OH bond into here to make the CO double bond and leave H plus. So you lose H minus and H plus. That is, you lose H2 effectively. Right? So you dehydrogenate the alcohol to make it into the aldehyde. But anyhow, if this were specific, if the dehydrogenase enzyme took only the pro-R, then the product would have only deuterium in it, not hydrogen at that position. And you can tell that by a number of different techniques, for example, IR or nuclear magnetic resonance, as we'll talk about next semester. Okay, now, that's a good test. That would really show whether you can do this kind of specificity between enantiotopic hydrogens. But it requires that you have this starting material with deuterium in the pro-R position and H in the pro-S position. How could you ever get that? Where would you ever get the starting material from? Any ideas? I'll give you a hint. The liver alcohol dehydrogenase is a catalyst, right? The actual thing that takes the H minus away is NAD plus, as it's called. We'll probably mention that next semester. So NAD plus takes H minus through a mechanism that involves this enzyme, right, and becomes NADH. Notice it was plus before. Now having H minus, it's no longer charged. Okay, so this thing is that the enzyme is a catalyst which allows NAD plus to take this and go over here. Now, does anybody have an idea how you might get this? Start on the right and go to the left. because a catalyst just helps a reaction go. It doesn't make it go one way or the other. It just enables it to go. Okay? So how could we make it go from the right to the left instead of the left to the right? Sonny? Yeah, you add NADH instead of NAD+. Right? So if we take an excess of NADH and start with the deuterium already in our starting material, right? Then you can make the reaction go this way and get the compound that you want if it is indeed specific, if it puts the H only on the pro-R position. Now, how will you know if you succeeded, if it did that? How will you know it didn't go 50% here and 50% here? Sonny? Yeah, but in principle it would rotate light. Okay, but in fact, it won't rotate light very much because hydrogen isn't very different from deuterium. It will indeed rotate light, and you can tell it that way, but you couldn't tell how pure it was because you'd have to know how many degrees would you expect if it were pure. It's not going to be very big. So how do you know whether what you get is small reflects 100% specificity or 1% specificity? You see the problem? There's a neat trick. You do a full cycle, right? Do you see now? You start with an excess of NADH and go over here, and then you complete it by putting a lot of NAD plus and no NADH and go back. And now, if it's specific, you'll have all deuterium here. You put this H on, and you took it off again by reversing the reaction. What if it wasn't specific? Yeah. Then you'll get both H and D here to the extent it got mixed up. Isn't that a cute experiment? So by first putting an excess of NADH and then an excess of NAD+, you make the thing go one way and then go back. And if it comes back exactly as it started with all deuterium there, then both steps must have been specific. I think that's a great experiment. Okay, so that proves that it's specific, but it doesn't prove which one it was. It doesn't prove whether it got the pro-R or the pro-S. It only proves that it was 100% whatever it was. Yeah.
Does it matter that D and H are slightly different?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the H and the D will be slightly different. Right, so one will react a little more rapidly than the other. So from that point of view, you wouldn't expect when you take it off, if it were going for both of them, if there were no intrinsic specificity, it wouldn't get exactly 50-50 because one would be marginally faster than the other. Okay, but it would be to a certain extent mixed up, and it's not at all mixed up. Okay. Good. So this proves that it's specific. Whether it's pro-R or pro-S required other experiments to see which one it was. And in fact, what's true is that some enzymes do only the R and other enzymes do only the S. And in fact, people are able to make classifications of enzymes on the behavior on the basis of which one they did. In fact, a person who took freshman organic chemistry the first time we offered it did that experiment of classifying enzymes that way. Now, so much for topicity. Now, strain. In 1885, Bayer added something. This picture is out in the hallway, incidentally. And the picture shows the chemists and the organic chemists at the Academy of Science in Munich in 1893. You'll see there's a web page about this if you want to look at it. And here, front and center, is Adolf von Bayer, who was a student of Kekulé. And here at the... over his left shoulder is Henry Lord Wheeler. Have you ever seen that? Do you know where that is? Where? Sinead? Can't hear you.
Is it
in the cemetery? No, it's not in the cemetery. Anybody ever seen that? No? Look on the left when you leave the building. Have you ever noticed that there are names carved there? Those are people who were members of the faculty mostly in the 19th century, right? And he was the first person, or before the building was built in 1923, he was the first person who established modern organic chemistry, because he had gone to Germany to study organic chemistry here, obviously with Bayer, and he came back. You'll notice that he died at 47, so he actually taught here for only 15 years or something like that. I don't know what he died of. But anyhow, he got organic chemistry started here at Yale, modern organic chemistry. Now, in 1885, Bayer published a paper on polyacetylene compounds. That is, compounds that have triple bonds linked to common carbon, so triple bond, single bond, triple bond, single bond, that kind of thing. These things were, and it was a single author paper. Bayer did a lot of his own experiments, which wasn't so very common in those days for the big professor. What's remarkable about polyacetylenes is that they are explosive, right? At the end, he thanks Dr. Homolka. It's not Dr. This was in 1885. I don't know exactly what Dr. Homolka's status was. He's not in the picture in 1893. Perhaps he got exploded. I don't know. Probably he just graduated and went on to some useful employment. But anyhow, Dr. Homolka presumably did some of these experiments because he gets thanked for it. In the context of this discussion of polyacetylenes and their great instability, Bayer made a number of comments relating to the theory of ring closure and the double bond, that is, making ring compounds and double bonds. Now, which a double bond can be thought of as the smallest possible ring. Okay. Now, what's the relationship? He said, ring closure is apparently the only phenomenon that can supply information about the arrangement of atoms in space. Okay. Now, of course, this is 11 years after Van't Hoff. So certainly the rotational light and these isomers we've been talking about has to do with arrangement of atoms in space. But it doesn't tell you which is which. Ring formation can tell you which is which. Do you remember our example we had of that? It was this one. Remember these two double bond cis and trans isomers? That the one on the left, when heated, can lose water and form a ring. The one on the right doesn't lose water as easily. Okay, and can't form a molecule, can't form a ring molecule. So that allowed you to know which one was cis and which one was trans. So ring closure was the phenomenon that could tell something about the arrangement of atoms in space, which is which. The existence of isomers was already with Van't Hoff, but which is which came from this ring formation. So he goes on to say, since a chain of five or six members can be closed easily, closed into a ring, while one of more or fewer members is difficult or impossible. Spatial factors are apparently involved. The previously proposed general rules on the nature of carbon atoms are the following, he said. One, carbon is tetravalent. Who said that? Cooper and Kekulé. Remember, Kekulé was his teacher. He was the guy that worked as a student in Kekulé's kitchen on arsenic compounds. Two, the four valences are equivalent, as shown by the fact there's only one monosubstitution product of methane. Three, the four valences are equivalently arranged in space and correspond to the corners of a regular tetrahedron inscribed in a sphere. So he's completely adopted Van't Hoff's point of view on that. 4. The atoms or groups attached cannot exchange places. So configuration, right? Evidence, there are two tetrasubstitution products, A, B, C, D, of methane. So that's Van 't Hoff's rule. And also the Frenchman, Lebel, came at the same time developed ideas very similar to Van 't Hoff's. 5, carbon atoms can bind to one another with 1, 2, or 3 valences, so you can have single, double, triple bonds. These compounds can be either open, that is, straight chain, or they can be in rings. And now, he says, I should like to add the following to these generally accepted rules. 7, the 4 valences of the carbon atom point in the directions connecting the center of a sphere to the corners of a tetrahedron, forming an angle of 109.5 degrees with one another. So he's now, Van 't Hoff just said they point generally in this direction, so you can have right and left-handed versions. Beyer is saying that the specific angle makes a difference. Right? And that if you don't have that angle, then there is strain in the compound. The direction of attachment can undergo alteration, but a strain is generated, increasing with the size of the deflection. Right? So this is relating reactivity to geometry. So this is a figure he draws, and he shows how much a bond is bent. So in when you make a double bond, a two-membered ring, the two bonds end up parallel. They started at 109 degrees and a half, right? So each one had to move by 54 degrees and 44 minutes in order to become parallel to one another, he says. And that strain, then, is going to make that the weakest ring. Dimethylene is indeed the weakest ring. And how does he know? Because it's so reactive. It reacts with HBr. It reacts with bromide. It even reacts with iodine, which is not such a very reactive halogen. Okay, now, why do we say it's reactive? Why do we say that it reacts with HBr? Sinead? Can't hear very well. Yeah, poor overlap means a high HOMO for the H plus low LUMO to react with. Okay, or in the case of Br2, the low LUMO is the sigma star. Okay, trimethylene, that's cyclopropane, is broken by HBr, but not by bromine, and obviously not by iodine. So why do we say it's reactive? Yeah?
Those bonds are bent because...
He says, he's saying they're bent, right? Bent, each bond, each valence coming out is bent by 24 degrees, 44 minutes, he says. And he says that bending makes it reactive. Why would, from a molecular orbital point of view, why do you say it's reactive? Mike? Poor overlap. Right, the bonds, the hybrids don't point at one another. And finally, tetramethylene, cyclobutane, and hexamethylene, cyclohexane, are difficult or impossible to break. So it's reactivity that makes Beyer say that that they're reactive. Incidentally, it's interesting to notice that he says, you know, 44 minutes, 44 minutes, 44 minutes, 34 minutes. That's a typo, or else he made it, or else he just wrote it wrong. I don't know. So his idea was that if you make a ring, including a six, now why would a six-membered ring be strained? Because the bonds are now too wide rather than too narrow, right? In a 60-degree angle, that's bad, but 120 degrees is also bad because you had to open it up from the tetrahedral angle. Now, a young guy named Soxie came along in 1890. That was 1885. In 1890, Soxie comes along and writes a paper that's almost like the Emperor's New Clothes, pointing out that Beyer is wrong about this, right? And he gives this funny picture in the paper. Actually, what it is something to be cut out and folded and pasted together. And what it is the blue part of this, right? It's six triangles in a row, right? You cut out and fold and make it into this thing. And then that's the base on which you cement these tetrahedra, right? Wherever it's shaded there. So this is Van 't Hoff style carbons. right? And when you do that, you get a compound that looks like that, a shape that looks like that, which is this shape here. Everybody see that? So it's exactly what we would write for cyclo, model for cyclohexane, right? There's what he said to do. Now, it wasn't such a great time to publish that paper, because the same time he published the paper in the Berlin journal, the Berichte der Deutschen Chemischen Gesellschaft, the main organic chemistry publication medium, there was a big celebration going on in Berlin for Kekulé to celebrate the benzene structure. Why was it such? It was a real blowout. They had an enormous banquet that lasted forever with a zillion rich courses and so on. And the reason was that the benzene had become the, and substituted benzenes had become the core of the German dye industry. So there was a lot of industrial money to apotheosize Kekulé. And of course Bayer was there as Kekulé's first and most prominent student. And so here this paper comes out that says, from a nobody, saying that Bayer is all wrong about this. Now, why is it wrong? He also had this model, which it makes two of these things that you paste together, and then you put carbons on like that, right? And if you do that, it looks like this. And the interesting thing about both of these models of cyclohexane is that they're made with tetrahedral carbons, right? They don't have 120 degree bond angles. The way you get smaller angles in a hexagon is to pucker the hexagon, right? In fact, it should pucker so that you don't have the strain, okay? So that was Soxie's modest proposal. But it wasn't well received. Julius Wagner in Leipzig, who was writing an abstract. There are journals that go through all the published papers and write little paragraphs saying what's important there, and then they get published so people can read these and see what big papers they want to read. That's something that's not quite as important as it used to be, since things are better indexed on the web now than they could have been then. But anyhow, when he wrote about this, he said it is not possible to write an abstract to this paper, especially since the author's explanations are hardly understandable without models. Now, what one might say is, hustle out and make these models and you'll see what the answer is. It's really beautiful. But his implication was, models, schmodels, you know, don't forget that. Okay, and Bayer in that same year replied, a further proposal is that the atoms in hexamethylene, that is cyclohexane, are arranged as in Kekulé's model, that is, that the arrangement of the atoms in space is the one with the minimum distortion of valence directions. Okay, we'll all believe that you don't want to distort the valence directions. But look what he concludes. Thus, the six atoms must lie in one plane. If the six carbons are in one plane, then it's a regular hexagon. You have 120 degree angles. And the six hydrogen atoms lie in each of two equidistant parallel planes. Now, I can't even make this that way. I can make half of it that way. But so that these five are all in a plane, so five of the hydrogens are pointing up, five are pointing down. If I could bring this one down into the plane, then there would be six up and six down. That's what he's talking about. But I can't do it without breaking the model, so I'm not going to do it. Okay. Further, each of the 12 hydrogen atoms must have the same position relative to the other 17. That is, they're all homotopic. Right? The experimental test of the correctness of this assumption is relatively easy. For example, sufficient evidence is that there is a single isomer of hexahydrobenzoic acid. There's only one cyclohexane carboxylic acid. Notice if you had this, that the silver ones don't have the same environment as the black ones. Can you see that? Right? Although if I do this, the silver ones take the position the black ones had, and the black ones take the position that the silver ones had. So this is a question of what? Configuration or conformation that I'm changing when I exchange the roles of the silver and the black ones. Am I changing configuration? Or am I changing conformation? All I'm doing is rotating about bonds. See that? So that happens relatively quickly. So you won't have different isomers, ones that are like this and others that are like this, even though the environments are indeed different, because they'll rapidly interconvert with one another. Okay? But Beyer doesn't realize that. He says if you have only one isomer of cyclohexane carboxylic acid, then it means the ring must be flat and therefore strained. Okay? Meanwhile, as long as our knowledge in this field is so incomplete, we must be satisfied that the above assumption is the most likely and no known fact contradicts it. Now, Soxie in 1892 wrote a 41-page journal, a 41-page article in this journal, the Zeitschrift, the newsletter for physical chemistry, not organic chemistry. And this is a more or less typical page, right? How do you think that struck the organic chemist audience for this question? How does it strike you? Pretty forbidding, right? This was not what organic chemists wanted to deal with. And notice that he published it in a journal edited by Ostwald, the guy who didn't even believe in atoms, and who Ostwald wrote of the guy who succeeded him in Riga when he went to the much more prestigious chair in Leipzig. He said, scientifically, he, the successor, had been brought up in the narrow circle of contemporary organic chemistry, and to him, the arrangement of atoms in space of the atoms of organic compounds was the foremost of all conceivable problems. Right? So this shows the difference in mindset between organic and physical chemists. So that didn't make any progress. So the next year, Soxie wrote another paper in the same journal, of which this is a fairly... So the first one was all trigonometry. This one's all geometry. And then he died at age 31 in 1893. So that was the end of Soxie's theory. Right? Beyer wrote in 1905, Soxie disagreed with my opinion that larger rings are planar. He is certainly right from a mathematical point of view. I strongly suspect that Beyer didn't go through every line of this to confirm that it was all correct, but he accepted that Soxie knew his math. Yet in reality, strangely enough, my theory appears to be correct. The reason is not clear. So he didn't have this idea that things could rotate about the bonds and interconvert. So what important lesson should we all take from the tale of poor Soxie? Right? That you have to bear your audience in mind when you're writing something, right? And don't publish the paper at the same day that this guy is talking about how great organic chemistry is. Don't call him an idiot at that point, right? Be a little more diplomatic, use a little more rhetoric in doing this, because Soxie was absolutely right. Remember this picture here? Bragg and Bragg, father and son, in 1913, determined the structure of diamond, crystalline diamond, by X-ray. And this picture, which was drawn by Ernst Mohr in 1918, confirmed Soxie's insight, because there, within it, you can see cyclohexane. There's Soxie's cyclohexane, right, precisely in there. So it was known already in 1918 that it would have been right. And that arrangement of the six-membered ring is called a chair. That's sort of a silly name, but if you want to justify it, you could look at a chair that's like this. And notice that within that particular chair is supposed to be so comfortable because you can pull the legs up and lean back and get the sun. That's from an Australian website, actually. But you can do the same thing with cyclohexane. You can pull the legs up and the back. And that's called ring flip by 60-degree counter-rotation of two parallel bonds. Now let's look at that. So here are two bonds that are parallel. And I'll rotate about that and rotate that one the opposite direction. The first one counterclockwise, the second one clockwise. And what that does to the two bonds that go down to the lower right carbon is to make them move up. Does everybody see if you rotate, that's going to move that carbon up? So it'll make it go up like that, right, into that location, which is called a boat. Okay? Now, if you then, in this boat form, people sometimes give silly names to this, like call that position the bowsprit and that position the flagpole and so on. But it's a little silly because the boat turns out to be a maximum of energy, not a minimum of energy. It's not a real isomer. But at any rate, if you then do the same trick with the blue ones, rotate them in and down, then you get that moved down like that. And you get this, which is the inverted chair. Now let me show you doing this. Okay, so it's down. Okay, so first I'm going to rotate about these two bonds and rotate this up. And then I'm going to rotate this one down. Right? And now the aluminum ones are up and down. And if I went back, now the black ones are up and down. Everybody see that? Now I'm going to... we just have a minute here, I think. Oh no, we don't have a minute. We could... I'll pass these around next time and you can try it yourself. If you actually feel it, it's helpful. Okay? So we'll continue with cyclohexane and its so-called inversion next time.